Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump continues to stoke racial divisions today after doing the same in speeches over the weekend. This morning, he tweeted criticism of NASCAR's decision to ban the Confederate flag. He also went after Bubba Wallace, NASCAR's only black driver who had found a noose in a garage he was assigned. The president said that was just another hoax, even though the FBI has determined it was not. For more on this and other political news, we're joined by NPR's White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Aisha, let's talk about the president's rhetoric. There was what he tweeted about NASCAR and the Confederate flag today. He also gave a speech at Mount Rushmore on Saturday where he blamed leftists for undermining American ideals. Here's part of that speech.
We will expose this dangerous movement, protect our nation's children, end this radical assault, and preserve our beloved American way of life.
Now, the president also went on to defend controversial monuments and announced the construction of a National Garden of American Heroes. Who is he appealing to with this?
It seems that he's trying to appeal to his largely white base by playing on grievances and divisions. And it was interesting this morning for him to explicitly talk about the NASCAR banning the Confederate flag, because over the weekend when he was reading off of, you know, the teleprompter reading these speeches, he did not explicitly mention the Confederacy and Confederate monuments, although that is what much of these arguments are about. But today he made clear that for him, this is also about, you know, defending the Confederate flag. And that is him positioning himself as this protector of a certain view of America and a certain way that he is talking to his base. And he's making the bet that he can have enough of his base come out that he can get reelected.
But it's interesting because even in a state with so many of his base voters like Mississippi, they're getting rid of the Confederate flag part of their state flag. It just is surprising that he's going this far down this road, especially when it may be a big turnoff for independent voters.
It is. And it seems like it is absolutely a gamble. I mean, you have NASCAR race car drivers coming out and telling President Trump, we don't need your support. This is NASCAR. You know, we're not talking about black NFL players. We're talking about NASCAR, which is thought of more of like a conservative base. And even Senator Lindsey Graham, who is a big supporter of President Trump, said in response to President Trump's tweet that the reason why NASCAR removed the Confederate flag is because they want to broaden their base, and that you can't do that with the Confederate flag. So it does seem out of step, even with the Republican Party, with conservative, you know, some conservatives in America.
Joe Biden, the president's opponent, had a very different 4th of July message. His campaign released a video. Let's listen to part of it.
We have a chance now to give the marginalized, the demonized, the isolated, the oppressed a full share of the American dream. We have a chance to rip the roots of systemic racism out of this country. We have a chance to live up to the words that have founded this nation.
Now, Aisha, as we've talked about, Joe Biden has been leading in a lot of the polls against Trump. How is he trying to appeal to voters in this moment, and does it seem to be working?
Well, if you look at the polls, it is working for him, and it seems because in many polls, he's leading some by double digits, and even in some very important swing states, he's up. It seems like much of what he's trying to do is to put himself, Biden is trying to put himself as the opposite of Trump, the anti-Trump, that he is, you know, going to focus on the coronavirus, that he's going to be the quote unquote adult in the room. He's going to wear a mask. He's going to not, you know, try to appeal to the you know, the quote unquote better natures and unify America. That's where he's going with this. And he's trying, but he's also kind of letting President Trump, I'm sure, be fine with him being out in front, with Trump being out in front and making this a referendum on President Trump.
Let me just briefly ask you, you mentioned the coronavirus. We're seeing the surge in cases. Do you expect a change in strategy from the White House to get the virus under control?
Not at this point. I mean, we saw this weekend where President Trump kind of downplayed the coronavirus, saying 99% of cases are totally harmless. That's not true. But it seems like what they are trying to say is that, you know, they're working on vaccines, they're working on therapeutics, that they're going to try to bring in some help, but they're not calling on a dramatic change in the way people address the coronavirus.
That is NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Aisha, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Brazil, a country that is relaxing coronavirus restrictions even as cases pile up. Brazil has confirmed 1.6 million infections and more than 64,000 deaths, the second highest total in the world behind the United States. The BBC's Katie Watson is in Sao Paulo on Skype. Katie, you're in Brazil's largest, hardest hit city. Describe the situation there today.
That's right. I mean, Sao Paulo, because it's the biggest city in the Southern Hemisphere, has got the highest number of cases. But I mean, it's also the wealthiest state. So it has managed to come out of this relatively well in the sense that there has not been an overrun of hospitals. The health care system hasn't collapsed. What we're seeing now in Brazil, the concern is that the virus is now moving from the large cities into the interior, so to smaller cities where people, if they do get the virus, will have to travel for many hours to get to a hospital. And even then, not all areas and not all states have the capacity for intensive care beds and that sort of thing. So that's the concern now.
And in the cities, it looks like in Rio, bars and restaurants have been allowed to reopen, and you'll get the green light for that to happen in Sao Paulo next week. How are people responding? Are people packing into bars and restaurants, or are they staying away?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, so Brazil and actually much of the region locked down roughly the same time as Europe, when they could see what was happening in Europe. This part of the world did lock down, but we're talking more than 3 months on. People have been getting very frustrated. People are very desperate as well, of course. There's a huge amount of people who work in the informal economy who rely on working every single day to be able to put food on the table for their families. So because of that desperation, because of the pressure, the political pressure to get back to some kind of normality. And of course, that comes from the top, with President Jair Bolsonaro has always, you know, prioritized the economy, saying that Brazil needs to get back to work. So we're seeing the economy start to reopen. So in Sao Paulo, malls have started to reopen already. Restaurants, bars shortly will be reopening. Rio last week saw bars reopen, and the pictures of the scenes there were certainly showing, you know, crowded bars, people keen to get back to that socializing and that sense of what it was like before. But the concern is, of course, is that this is a country that many believe has not reached the peak.
Right.
And of course, a lot of experts are saying that this is just too early to be reopening.
Mm. Tell me more about the government's response. We see that President Bolsonaro actually vetoed part of a law that would require face masks across the country. It sounds like you're having the same debate there in Brazil as we're having here in the United States, and it's become politicized.
Absolutely. And I was talking to a public health expert who said exactly that, that these, you know, these health initiatives had become political, and that it was really, you know, at the cost, of course, of the population. Jair Bolsonaro has, from the very beginning, rubbished social distancing. He has continued to meet his supporters in crowds, most of the time not wearing a mask. What's happened is it's been a split between the states and the federal response. So most of the states have implemented measures such as making it mandatory to wear masks in public, introducing quarantine measures. That's why we've seen a lot of the bars and restaurants and businesses closed down to the public. And then, of course, Jair Bolsonaro taking a different approach on the federal level. But this was a law that was introduced, the first federal law that was introduced. Now, he passed most of the law, but he did veto certain elements of it, including shops and churches and closed spaces that they had wanted to make a mask wearing mandatory. But he said that would infringe on private space. And so mask wearing in those areas is not mandatory. But the fact that he signed this law shows that he's kind of having to fall into place in some ways, in some respects, to what the rest of the country has been doing for many weeks now.
Finally, I want to ask you about some connections to other problems that Brazil has been witnessing over the last couple of months, really years. Some conservation groups are saying that the government is so distracted by the coronavirus that deforestation and fires in the Amazon, even worse than it has been in the past. Have you seen evidence of that?
It's twofold. It's people illegally going in when the backs of the authorities are turned, and the concern, of course, is what that means for not just the land and the deforestation, but for indigenous communities who are the most vulnerable in this. And the concern is that COVID-19 will hit those communities with lower immunities, and that will have a devastating effect on the indigenous communities of Brazil. But the fire season, of course, as well, is about to hit here in Brazil. And the concern is that, what this year will mean for Brazil, because last year, of course, was devastating for the Amazon.
That's the BBC's Katie Watson in Sao Paulo. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
School districts are starting to release their plans to reopen in the fall, despite a great deal of uncertainty over the coronavirus. The Fairfax County school system outside of Washington, D.C. is one of the country's largest districts. It's asking parents and teachers to essentially vote on how to reopen. By the end of the week, they'll have to choose 100% remote learning or 2 days a week in the classroom. The school year is scheduled to start August 25th. Becca Farrick is president of the Association of Fairfax Professional Educators and a high school librarian. Becca, welcome.
Thanks so much, Peter.
And what's your reaction to this plan to let parents and teachers decide how they want to do it come fall?
I applaud the opportunity to choose, but I'm disappointed that the choices that students make will determine how many of us teachers are allowed to make choices.
What do you mean? Tell me more about that.
FCPS has put out a survey to both parents and teachers asking essentially the same question. What would you prefer for your student or for yourself in terms of working for the fall? To be 100% virtual or to come back in a limited face-to-face and virtual hybrid interaction? Unfortunately, the student demand for online learning will drive staffing needs. So our teacher placements will be contingent upon student enrollment numbers in the online program. As you can imagine, with COVID, young people are not quite as concerned as older teacher-aged people about contracting COVID-19. So we anticipate that there will be a big difference between the number of students who want to be online all the time and the number of teachers who would feel safest being online all the time.
I see. So it sounds like you're saying it's very possible that what parents and students want may be at odds with what the teachers want. And you mentioned the students, but what about the parents out there who say, I need my kid to go back to school so that I can go back to work? What do you say to them?
I absolutely understand, because like other professionals who need school or childcare to allow them to do their work, so do professional educators. We are in a bind when it comes to providing education and childcare for others, because we too have children to take care of.
So what's the solution?
I don't think there is one, to be honest.
Really? Right.
I think FCPS and other school leaders have been put in an absolutely impossible situation. We're asking them to provide a plan that will satisfy needs and desires of all members of our community. And in some cases, those needs and desires are diametrically opposed. And we're asking them to make decisions based on a pandemic that is still utterly confounding, and based on scientific information that is still evolving and nowhere near complete.
Okay, so let's just play out a few of the possible scenarios then. In your mind, is there any way that going back to school in person, even for just a few days a week, could be made safe if you had to do it?
I think there are precautions that can be taken. I am reluctant to agree that those precautions will be adequate by the time the community wants us to return in August. I still think the uncertainty is too great to even know what kinds of precautions we should take and whether or not they will be adequate to protect everyone in our school community.
In other words, putting kids in desks 6 feet apart, making sure everyone's washing their hands every hour may not be enough.
Right. We are still waiting on specific protocols in terms of daily screenings. We would also like to know what specific protocols would be followed in the event of a known exposure or positive test results, and what kind of criteria must be met in order for either a student or a teacher to return to a face-to-face instructional environment.
But aren't there also problems with the other option? Because if families choose to go virtual, from what we can tell, it sounds like it is a year-long commitment. And
that's
virtual
correct.
Learning, right? I mean, that's not a perfect situation either. We just spoke to an educator last week who said students have lost a ton of ground learning virtually. So how do you make that situation better?
That, too, is a conundrum. I do have more confidence in educators' abilities to provide better distance learning than we were able to in an emergency situation last spring. I can tell you that we became teachers to touch lives, literally. And we can make distance learning work, but it lacks the same magic for us as it does for our students. But right now, we're faced with having to surrender some of that magic in order to protect health and safety of our community and perhaps to save lives.
Have educators been putting in the time to make sure that if kids go back in the fall, that the virtual learning will be better than it was?
That is an excellent question. I wish that due to the uncertainty, we had kind of admitted long ago that the only safe alternative, at least for now, is to err on the side of health and safety and to go completely virtual. Had that decision been made months ago, we could have been hard at work for the last several months learning and upgrading and planning and producing some distance learning that would be really spectacular.
Becca Farrick is president of the Association of Fairfax Professional Educators and a high school librarian. Becca, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Peter.
And we reached out to the superintendent of Fairfax County Schools. He was not available for an interview today. Well, parks and trailheads are also reopening around the country, allowing people to get back into nature after coronavirus lockdowns. But not everyone has the same access to open spaces. Black people have often felt excluded and unwelcomed outdoors. Monica Samayoa of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports on an effort to change that.
Before Tara Cooper moved to Portland, she fell in love with Oregon's lush green forests and what seemed like never-ending opportunities to enjoy nature. But once she arrived with her son, things changed.
I would love to have been able to go camping more or do more nature-y things and even do some off-the-grid camping if the opportunity came up. But I would never do that in Oregon.
Cooper is Black, and she says when she did go out for a hike, she felt unwelcome by white people, invisible, and that she didn't belong.
But just the way they're staring at you lets you know there's something wrong. You don't belong here. Who are you and why are you here? And it's not like they're looking at all strangers that way. They're looking at me and my son that way.
There's mounting scientific evidence that spending time surrounded by nature helps reduce stress and improves our physical and mental health. It's not strictly economic inequality that is keeping so many in the Black community from accessing outdoor recreation. Outdoor diversity groups have found that it's common for Black people to feel excluded, uncomfortable, and unwelcome when they try to enjoy outdoor activities. RUMAP is the CEO and founder of the nonprofit organization Outdoor Afro, which focuses on empowering, connecting, and celebrating Black people in nature. She said fixing the issue is not as easy as putting up welcome signs at a park.
We have to really remember our history when we're talking about Black people in the outdoors. And not forget that there's people like a living generational memory of people who've experienced terror and all kinds of, you know, signs and symbols of unwelcoming.
Last year, the National Park Service had 327 million visitors in all its national parks. Surveys show only 6% of those visitors were Black. Meanwhile, more than 70% of park visitors were white. Recent data from the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department reveals Black people are among the most underrepresented visitors to state parks. They make up 2.2% of Oregon's population and less than 1% of day visitors. Spokesman Chris Havel says his department has been struggling with this issue for years and has been working with community organizations to find solutions.
And that's meant having really challenging conversations with our own staff, reaching out to those community groups for group and one-on-one meetings, working with representatives in those communities to do different kinds of media outreach, and even hosting events.
U.S. Navy veteran Chad Brown has experienced racism beyond hiking trails and campgrounds. Brown is a Black man whose favorite outdoor activity is fly fishing. It's a predominantly white sport, and when he reaches a remote part of the river, he senses that people immediately start sizing him up, even down to what kind of gear he has. This is what he calls the white savior mentality.
I'm the expert, or this is my house, or this is my land, or this is my river type of mentality where I have to come to you for permission.
He's also had his life threatened on several occasions, and he's thought about what would happen if he used his gun to protect himself or his dog.
The bottom line is two things are going to happen to me. Either I'm going to go 6 feet under, or I'm going to get hauled off and go to jail.
But Brown says he's not one to let racism keep himself or other people of color from enjoying the outdoors. He created an organization called Soul River, Inc., which works with veterans and youth of color from cities like Portland, introducing them to outdoor recreational activities. Brown takes his group into wild places. They learn about ecosystems and the environmental challenges confronting these places. Most importantly, he provides a safe space and says the organization works to dismantle the ignorance, hate, and racism Black youth and other people of color face. Among the people that Brown's taken on what he calls deployments into the outdoors are Tara Cooper and her son.
I was actually assigned as an adult volunteer to go on a deployment, and my son found out and had a fit. He's like, you're going camp? Am I going?
She said one of the main reasons she felt comfortable going on the outing with her son was the fact that the leader of the group was a Black man. For Here and Now, I'm Monica Samayoa.
Goldman Sachs has crunched the numbers, and they say a national mandatory mask order could help the economy in a big way. According to Goldman, if everyone wears a mask, then states wouldn't need to impose mandatory lockdowns. As things are, those lockdowns are expected to shave off 5% or more of gross domestic product. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And we should note here that in this study, Goldman assumes a mask is a perfect substitute for a stay-at-home order, which may or may not be the case. But tell us more about what they're saying.
First of all, isn't it amazing where we are, where the chief economist and the team at Goldman, led by Jan Hatzius, that they are actually studying virus spread? That's what is actually driving the economy. And I do think that's an important thing to underscore. So they found that face masks are associated with better coronavirus outcomes. And then what they try to do is they try to take that analysis and understand the economic impact. And as you said, they believe that, you know, if this were sort of a substitute for a lockdown, we could kind of save ourselves in a 5% further contraction in the economy.
A 5% further contraction in the economy. What are people expecting if there is no mask mandate this year?
Well, you know, the estimates are all over the place, and we see that there are some economists who think that the U.S. economy will be 5% smaller at the end of this year. There are others who think it's 10 or 12% smaller at the end of this year. The Federal Reserve and a lot of their number crunching indicates probably a shrinkage of about 8% is what they believe by the end of this year. So that's just from the beginning of the year to the end of the year.
Now, whether we have a mask mandate or not in this country and whether we have more lockdowns or not, it's pretty clear that the coronavirus is not under control here, and it's certainly not as under control as it appears to be in Europe and as it appears to be in China. China had a good day in the markets today, the Shanghai Index up nearly 6%, the biggest gain since 2018. What's driving the optimism there? And is the U.S. at risk of really falling behind competitively if other countries can open up and we can't?
Well, Jeremy, you've known me for a long time, and you know that I hate trying to figure out why markets move on any single day. But today I might have an idea that there was a front page editorial in the Chinese state-owned journal called the China Securities Journal. I know your subscription ran out. But this editorial actually said fostering a healthy bull market was important. given China's increasingly complicated relations. And so there is some idea that maybe Chinese people actually got kind of behind that. But what I think is important is that if the U.S. economy takes a lot longer to recover from this period, we are going to see places like China fill in the gaps. And whether that is our medical equipment and health equipment that we've come so much to rely on, that there are opportunities. It could even be through the 5G networks that are being built. So I do think there is a critical issue about making sure this virus doesn't spread so much that we lose our advantage in many areas of the economy.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Much of the U.S. is struggling to contain the coronavirus, with more than 43,000 new cases reported yesterday alone. The 7-day average of new cases hit a record high for the 27th straight day, as public health officials in some states warned that the resurgent virus could soon overwhelm their healthcare systems. Let's bring in Tom Frieden, who is former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Jeremy.
So 13 states reported new highs in their 7-day case averages just in the last few days. What do you think is behind these new spikes in COVID-19 cases, especially in the South and the West?
It's no surprise. It's no secret. We opened too early in too many places. And in many places, we opened when cases were increasing. When you lean into a punch, you get hit hard. And if you take one step too far forward too fast with COVID, you're going to have to take two or three steps backwards. This is a big challenge, and it's going to continue for weeks, if not months. We're all in this together, and we're going to have to fight it together.
Well, one of the things that we've noticed is that the states that are seeing these big spikes are states where it is very hot right now. Texas, Arizona, Nevada, South Carolina, places where it might be more difficult for people to spend time outdoors if they're going to get together as opposed to indoors. Do you think that that is contributing?
Well, a couple of months ago, people were saying without any evidence that there was going to be less COVID in the warm weather. And I think we can't really predict what's going to happen. This is a new organism. It hasn't been circulating among people before. But there's no mystery. If people are getting together, not wearing masks, COVID is going to spread, and it will spread increasingly. What we've got to do, really, is get away from this situation where the virus has the upper hand so that we can turn the tide and we can save lives, we can get our kids back to school in the fall, and we can restore our economy. We're going to have to do that, but that's going to require no large indoor gatherings, no open bars, probably no open restaurants in most of these places with widespread transmission, and masks, certainly anytime you're indoors with near others and sometimes when you're out of doors as well, and masks worn correctly. Down below your nose or down at your neck doesn't help.
Well, when you say you should maybe not have restaurants or businesses open in places that are seeing widespread transmission, by the time you have widespread transmission, isn't it too late to make that call? I mean, should places like New York that have dropped the transmission way down, should they feel comfortable at this point opening things back up again, or would that be too soon?
Governor Cuomo made the right call here. He decided not to allow restaurants to open in New York City for indoor service, and that's exactly the right thing. What we've seen from around the country is, first off, some places opened bars. That's a really bad idea. You've got lots of people in an indoor space for many hours, mixing freely and not wearing masks. That's a formula for the spread of COVID, and we've seen many outbreaks related to bars. But what we're seeing in places that closed bars and kept restaurants open were that restaurants functioned kind of similar to a bar. Lots of people came in, spent a long time, didn't wear masks, and mixed. And that's a formula for widespread transmission of the virus. Unfortunately, when it's spreading widely, you really have to increase physical distance quite substantially to cool the virus down. When you have explosive spread in a place like Phoenix, where as many as 1 in 30 people may be infectious today, you're going to have people extremely physical distance. And that's going to have to continue for weeks and weeks. It took 6 to 8 weeks for New York City cases to cool down.
One of the big questions all along, and it doesn't seem like there's an answer to it yet, has had to do with whether you become immune if you've had the virus and recovered from it. Do you have any greater sense about whether that is the case? And if it is not, if you can get the virus and then be reinfected, wouldn't we be hearing about a lot of people getting reinfected with the virus at this point?
This is one of the most important unanswered questions about coronavirus. We don't know whether prior infection protects you, whether it protects you well and for a long time, whether it protects you from getting sick or just infected. What we are learning is that there is a strong response of the body to infection in some cases, not in all cases, but in many cases. We still don't know whether that results in protective immunity, and if so, how long that will last.
On Saturday, President Trump said the U.S. will likely have a therapeutic and or a vaccine solution long before the end of the year. Do you agree with that outlook?
On the one hand, we are learning some ways to treat people better. We're learning how to give oxygen, how to position patients, some medications that appear to make the disease less severe for people who are very, very ill. On the other hand, a vaccine is a very complicated undertaking, and there cannot be any compromising on safety for vaccines. No cutting corners. There's already so much suspicion about vaccines. We need complete transparency at every step of the way. We hope there'll be a vaccine, but getting a vaccine isn't simple. It means figuring out the dose, figuring out if it's safe, if it's effective, who's going to get it first, getting it produced, figuring out who's going to pay for it and distributing it, tracking for adverse reactions. It's a major undertaking and needs to be done very carefully and with full transparency.
So that sounds like probably not by the end of the year.
For a vaccine to have it actually available for a significant number of Americans, very unlikely.
Australia says it is going to restrict travel between its two most populous states as the pandemic worsens there. Do you think that that is something that should be considered in the United States? Let's say the Northeast cuts itself off from the other states while the Northeast seems to be getting better and other areas are getting worse.
It's certainly the case that travel from places with a lot of COVID is a major source of infection in places that have cleared it. And what we will see inevitably and are seeing already around the world and potentially around the U.S. are restrictions on travel from places that don't have it under control by places that do have it under control. It's almost unthinkable that something like that would happen in the United States. But on the other hand, if the differences are so enormous, it's almost unthinkable that that wouldn't happen here.
Well, we are starting to see travel pick up. The TSA reported today that they screened more than 700,000 people over the holiday weekend. That's the first time that that has happened, that number, since the start of the pandemic. Does that worry you, or do you look at that and say, okay, well, that makes sense. We're getting back to normal.
Well, on the one hand, we do want economic activity returning. And if people are traveling among areas with similar levels of spread, that reduces the likelihood that you'll increase the spread. But anytime there's travel from a place with a lot of COVID to a place with not much COVID, you have a high risk of it spreading.
I want to ask you one more thing about something that obviously has been top of mind over the last several weeks. The New York Times sued the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to get more data about the racial disparities in coronavirus infection rates. And the data show that Black and Latino people have been three times more likely than white people to get the virus and nearly twice as likely to die from it. What would you be doing if you were at the CDC right now to address these racial disparities in the pandemic?
We need to do three things. First, reduce exposures. There's far too much exposure in Black, Hispanic, Latino, Latina communities from essential work and from multifamily households or multi-generational households where there can be a lot of spread. Second, we need to address some of the underlying health conditions that are driving the increased vulnerability to infection and severe infection, such as uncontrolled diabetes. And third, we need to improve access to health and social services because there is much less access to health care, and even among people with health insurance, much worse outcomes in African American and Latinx populations.
If you had the ear of President Trump right now, what would you tell him?
We need a national strategy, a national plan. We need accountability at every level of government, federal, state, and county. We need transparency about what we're doing, where the virus is, and we need straight talk about what is going to happen in the coming weeks and months. It's going to be hard, but if we work together, we can get through it together. Coronavirus will continue to spread until we stop it. It's not going to stop on its own.
That is Tom Frieden, former director of the CDC. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Something is killing elephants in Botswana. Nearly 400 have been found dead since the beginning of May, and conservation groups are alarmed by the mystery as the population of elephants declines across Africa. For more, we're joined by Niall McCann on Skype. He's director of conservation at the National Park Rescue and a National Geographic Explorer. Niall, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. And what do we know about why so many elephants are dying in Botswana?
Unfortunately, we know very little at this stage. So back in early May, a group of conservationists did a flight to try and assess how bad a problem this was, and they spotted 169 carcasses. Mm. So that immediately set alarm bells ringing. But a month later, it was discovered that the government hadn't done anything about it by that point. They hadn't sent any samples to be tested, so no one knew what was going on. And when the team went back and did another survey, they counted almost 400 elephants, with many others wandering around in a confused state, probably not far from death.
Wow. What else did they learn during that survey? Any other clues that would give hints at what could be going on?
Well, the most perplexing clue, I suppose, is the fact that this is only in the elephant population. Normally, if you've got a poison or a toxin, it would have a knock-on impact on some of the other animals nearby. So if it was a cyanobacteria, blue-green algae in the water, then you'd see lots of other animals dying around waterholes. Or if it was a poison like cyanide, which is often used in that area to poison elephants, you would see dead scavengers like vultures and jackals and hyenas. And we're seeing none of that.
Huh. Okay, first of all, why would someone poison an elephant, even if this is not the case? And do you think this could be poaching, you know, more specifically?
I do think it could be poaching. It's one of the three most likely possibilities, along with being a natural occurring toxin or being a pathogen, a disease of some form. The reason people poison elephants in that part of the world is again, twofold. Firstly, it's farmers and other landowners who don't like elephants because they do come and they trash your crops. Mm. They break down your houses. They can be very aggressive to people. The reality of living next to elephants is nowhere near as idyllic as we might think it is. The other reason you would poison an elephant is to kill it to get its ivory, because the ivory from an elephant still fetches in the region of $700 per kilo on the black market over in Southeast Asia.
I do know some conservation groups have said the government is not doing enough to figure out what's going on. You've hinted at that. What do you think? Is enough being done?
I would say that enough is not yet being done, and there are various reasons for that. At the moment, of course, like anywhere else in the world, the government of Botswana are dealing with COVID-19. They're dealing with a pandemic and a lockdown that's having a massive knock-on effect on their population of people. And to commit resources to what at the moment they think is probably just a conservation issue might be seen as prioritizing the lives of elephants over the lives of people by some rural communities, because that's been an accusation that's been frequently levied at the previous administration. What I'm really trying to emphasize to the government of Botswana is that this has the potential to be a public health crisis as well. If it's a disease, we've already seen with COVID-19 that disease can very easily transmit from animals and into people and back again. It's not just COVID-19. Look at Ebola, HIV, SARS, MERS. So many of the diseases that we have today in human populations originated in wildlife. So if this is a disease, that could get into people. Or if it's a poison or a toxin, equally, that could have a massive knock-on effect on human populations, because the Okavango Delta is a sponge for water. And much of that water then ends up being consumed by people further down the line. And if that's contaminated, the potential for human risk there is also very high.
A little context here. Botswana is home to a large population of elephants. In fact, a third of the population across Africa. How critical are these deaths to the population in general of this species?
Highly critical. And you're very right. Botswana has a third of all the elephants left in Africa, which makes it the most important country in the whole continent for the survival of one of the most iconic species on Earth, a species that has massive knock-on effects on its environment, huge cultural importance to humanity as well, a species that we cannot afford to lose. Already at the moment, we've lost 1/1000th of the global population have gone already in this area of Botswana as a result of whatever this is. The population, the total population in that part of northern Botswana stands at about 15,000. So that's between 3% and 4% of the total population of elephants. And at the moment, there's nothing to say that they won't all succumb to whatever this is.
Mm. So what else are you thinking now? Because that's not the only problem they're facing. As we mentioned, poaching is a major issue. Climate change, drought, things like that. What else is on your mind?
Well, I think you've made the point very well that all of these things are on their mind because all of these things are linked. We live in a world that's totally integrated into our environment. Our environment props up our economy. It doesn't undermine our economy. We have to take a One Health approach to conservation, thinking that human health and environmental health are linked because they are. COVID-19 is the perfect example of that. We had a breakdown in conservation happen, leading to a disease jumping from what was probably a bat into possibly a pangolin across into people in a market somewhere in China. And that has then shut down the entire world. If we had been able to defend those wild animals in their wild habitats, that wouldn't have happened in the first place. And we have to understand that human health, wealth, and well-being is absolutely underpinned by environmental integrity.
That's Niall McCann, Director of Conservation at the National Park Rescue and a National Geographic Explorer. Niall, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.